time.
So you could have had a position there.
I did. Well, I took a position.
You did have one.
Right. I was immediately appointed to staff. And as a matter of fact, when I left here, I received in 77, because I was appointed to staff in 52. And that's my 25th year.
Okay.
I'm still a member of the Harvard Center. But I was much more active in the first few years.
Jointly with Bart, teaching the course in radio astronomy.
I see.
Which was the first course taught in radio astronomy anywhere in the U.S.
Well, hold on now. To be fair, Vanderholt's...
Right. But I'm...
He gave a first semester course.
That course. And...
But you and...
I'm talking about leading to...
So, it's a little bit different than I was thinking then. I was thinking that you were off with your company, and Bach was at Harvard, but you were both at your company and at Harvard.
That's right.
And how long did that sort of continue?
As long as Bach was there before.
I see.
Right up until he left. Right. And that's when I, shortly after, I guess, Gull left, and I recommended to Bach that Lilly be brought on from Yale. And after Lilly had accepted and moved in, and Bach went to Australia, then I left Harvard, actively teaching.
Right. But you still supplied receivers and...
Well, not really that much.
So
receivers for academia are a place to really get in, put yourself out of business in a hurry. That's not really a good
thing.
And my problem was, I didn't want to be in business in the first place. There was another question, how this lasted so long, because I delivered the receiver. But we were about halfway into it, and John Hagen called from NRL and said they wanted one. Well, it didn't occur to me at the time. The reason he wanted one, of course, was that if he had one, then these graduate students, which was really what I meant by the first course, it was a graduate course leading to doctorates, and the students were
program,
Drakes and the Haitians and the Lillies and the Higgins. They were all students that we were producing. And the machinery, many of the places they were going, the instrumentation wasn't available. And when Hagen called, I thought, well, now that we've got 3 months into the Harvard machine, at least we know enough about our mistakes for another 15K. So it was a 15K type thing. We'll build two. We'll build one for NRL, we'll build one for Harvard, and that'll be it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying that all the way through, the one for Berkeley, and then the one for British Columbia, Michigan, and everybody wanted one. And then Greenback. I think about the last one was when the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, they said, Doc, you've got to do it, because many of these fellows felt that the contribution I had made was... Getting the line, that's one thing. But then putting the United States in business of getting data and cranking out doctorates, working, showing that an astronomer and a funk-type cat, me, could work together to produce hardware and doctorates and put the U.S. in the business.
Yeah.
Almost overnight. That was
But now, by the time you... made this last receiver for NRAO, of course, you and Knight had gotten into many other things.
Oh, yes.
Right. It was just a very minor part of it.
Yeah, the problem was that there were so many of these going along, and then I had to make a pretty basic decision whether I was going to stay on at Harvard. And that was at about the time that Bach was making some basic decisions whether he was going to stay.
Right.
And I'd had enough interfacing with the academic life to have some questions in my mind whether that was really the life.
Yeah.
And so when he left, I pretty much made up my mind and bit the bullet and gone other directions, so that actually at the time that he left, Ewan Knight was very much into things like troposcatter. We built the 22 tons of transmitters that went on the Texas towers and things like that. We were doing completely different things.
Yeah.
And that's why I formed E-Day at one point, was in case there was a need for these receivers, to have them done separately in a way that I could keep track of my losses over here and say, well,
I see.
That's my friendship club and those boys, and that's their thing.
Now, I haven't heard about this before. This E-Day company, is that just a play on night?
That's right. E-Day? It also was the initials of 56. Marianne and I were married, and so we decided our firstborn would be either Donald Arthur or Deborah Ann. So we had DAE, and we had the initials, and said, okay, we'll call it Ewan Day. I'm actually, very shortly, I plan to liquidate both of those corporations, because they're now very much in real estate as well. They're in too many things. I plan to condense it all into another company, and that company, I would think, very shortly is going to be on the books, and it's, I'm using the initials of my fourth son, and he's Mark Edward Ewan, and I thought, the You and Me Corporation. And don't spell me right. Two E's. So I assure you that within a couple of years, or maybe this year, we will have a You and Me Corporation.
That's beautiful.
So it's a night, day, and me, and we never spell any of this right. But,
okay. But getting back now to the mid-50s, I agree with you on your assessment of getting radio astronomy going in the U.S. But what would be your comments on the science? I mean, certainly the people that were produced were critical for U.S. in the late 50s and 60s and even today. But what about the observations that were done themselves at Harvard? It seems to me that there was a loss because these people were not building their own receivers, as was the mode of radio astronomy up to then. There were over-interpretation of bumps and so forth, which led to some well-known misinterpretations. I mean, do you agree with me? And if so, how did this come about? Or?
Well, the question is, should the observer be more than intimately familiar with the design? Should he be a hands-on type? I think the students knew enough about the instrument. I would, in the long term, Paul, and I made a comment at the time that I felt that ultimately we should be able to hook a computer up to an antenna and let it operate remotely somewhere and provide the information to astrophysicists to interpret. And that the assurance that the data was valid should be provided by engineers on site who maintain and operate the equipment. But other than specifying what is to be measured and then transferring that to the other mountain, and leaving the responsibility, I would leave the responsibility for instrumentation, calibration, and operation with engineering. I would insist that the one who's to publish the paper or carry out the research be responsible for all of the pointing programs. In other words, where are we going to look? For what period of time? What will be the parameters of the
observation? But not for calibration also?
Calibration as well, right? But calibration is external. You know, the fellow should think about, he should think about the box that he's going to do something for him.
Right.
And he should never have the calibration in the box.
Well, this is the philosophy on which the national observatories operate now, of course, where a user comes in for a few days and uses, he has manuals given to him and so forth. And so you were thinking that this was your philosophy
then. That was my feeling at the very beginning. Yeah. And I did not see that much was being gained by having these students run out there and diddle with the knobs and more than anything else upset the instrument than to just hire one engineer who would worry about keeping that system in operation at all times and assure them. Well, provide, you know, I'd rather spend more time describing the details and the philosophy of approach, or provide assurance that is external to the system, or
yep.
would like to perform a measurement,
right.
to assure himself that that box is really performing a function,
right.
than to push a button that says cal. I wouldn't believe that. So. The idea of we all have to run out to what I then termed Agony Station and diddle with knobs, I found not really the way to go. And I was very happy when Haystack came online, computer-operated control, and suggested even in the days of NIROC that perhaps what we should do are Greenbank. And I like the idea of Greenbank in Charlottesville. I didn't really push hard for that because I was on the committee of site selection for the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. And the game was, we're going to find the quietest possible site. Well, with various forces that enter into selecting a site, there were also forces that suggested that we should be in some of the best deer hunting country and other nice places like that. Why don't we just pick one thing that focuses attention on radio astronomy, like radio noise, quiet from a radio standpoint, and then consider that for human needs, there perhaps would be some other place that we should locate the people who are going to operate on the data, and very important that they have some place to get together and talk, not a place to go diddle with a knob when they're not that familiar with what's behind the panel. And I don't think they should be that familiar. That's really asking a mountain to form another mountain without recognizing the valley that exists. You would never get the mountain stronger.
But of course, the British and Australians were precisely those sort of people built and interpreted the data.
Well, a fortunate circumstance, I think, in both cases, and probably a different approach in education, that they were able to go down that road.
Mm-hmm.
I would think, depending on the particular phenomena, and also the, of course, as we mentioned earlier, the club-type arrangement. We had the phenomenon of clubs here much more strongly in place. Astronomers, engineers, and so on, physicists, wherever they are. You don't see that. At least I haven't in my visits to Australia and to Europe.
Mm-hmm. As a more interdisciplinary
absolutely. Approach. Much greater. At least there is a mutual respect.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't the looking down on it, sort of, I could even feel that a little at Harvard, We have Kraft and we have Jefferson, of course. At Jefferson, we have a great physicist, and Kraft, we have these so-called engineers. And that sort of clubby type class system, very, very American for some reason. I think it's all going away now, but then it was pretty horrendous.
While we're touching on this, could you comment on why the U.S. didn't really get going with radio astronomy, despite the radiation lab and all the radar developments during the war, like the British and the Australians do? What do you think was the ingredient that was missing, if that's what it was?
I think there was as much interest in the U.S. in scientific communities among the disciplines that were capable of moving ahead as rapidly as in England or Australia. The missing ingredient in the U.S. was the recognition of the value of this as a separate science or as a combination of important disciplines. There was no, quotes, requirement for it. And we were, in those days, right after World War II and immediately following into the Korean War, and then throughout the 50s, searching for requirements to be met. And it became the game of the government laboratory, and the Defense Department in particular, to demand that a requirement be fulfilled by any research. So you almost had to guess the future and then demonstrate your ESP brilliance. And many of the proposals were filled with this type of hogwash that the Defense Department insisted on. And this was all to benefit the taxpayer, to assure that we wouldn't...
It was all relevant.
Just so that we wouldn't get this Proxmire funny that I'm glad that finally Proxmire got his funny.
Right, got his back. So really what you're saying then is that the Cold War, the military domination of scientific funding was the difference
that was
between this country and the other.
Focused on the requirement, and there was no requirement for this. And as far as the work that was done at in Australia and in England, it was motivated by the need for better knowledge of this new emerging field. I mean, there was very pure, very basic, very natural.
There was no military funding connected with these things.
The thing that I found very interesting was that though there appeared to be no interest in this, lack of publications, meetings of disciplines that you would imagine would be active here, there was an underground here, and it was quite active, and people at NRL and at AFCRL and within the universities were pursuing this, but were not advertising it. When it was, when spark or whatever, when it was a spark, as much as the respect was allowed in the discipline, suddenly, overnight, the U.S. Out of the woodwork, we had all of these research facilities immediately ready to go. I mean, NRL had plans, antennas were going up, and AFCRL with their solar work. So what were they doing in the meantime? They were able to pursue the research despite the fact that they were held back by these requirement.
And when do you see this blossoming period?
Early 50s.
The early 50s.
Right. I think right after that. Throughout the 50s, things took off. Once we were able to say that Harvard, for example, is giving a course for a doctorate in radio astronomy. Papers are being published that California and Michigan and the government laboratory, that everyone is coming together and recognizing this, that the American Astronomical Society is going to admit that engineers exist, that all of this happened shortly thereafter. Yeah. Just each little piece of it fell together very quickly.
There was this meeting in 1954 in Washington, D.C., that was sponsored by the National Academy of Sciences, I believe, about radio astronomy in the U.S. I don't know if you actually went to it. You know the one I mean?
I don't recall.
It was in Washington, D.C. The proceedings are published in JGR. I was going to ask you if you thought that was an important meeting or not, in terms of the way things went. It came out with a strong recommendation for a national observatory, and saying, decrying, you know, how the U.S. is lying behind and so forth.
Well, I remember being on several committees with fellows like Van Etten and Merrill too. And
I think this was probably one of those early committees decided to have such a meeting.
Right, and trying to get the National Observatory off the ground. I think it's the biggest problem at that time was the regional impact. You know, if we're going to put up a large antenna in West Virginia, what are we going to do?
Take money away.
What are we going to do for California? Right. And what's Harvard going to have? And that was part of the problem with the VLA.
Sure. Well, it's a constant tussle between the universities and the national labs, of course.
I think what really made the field of radio astronomy more than anything else was Bart Bok's sheer guts to make sure it happened. He, prolific writer.
He had all sorts of PR articles.
Just going all the time. Right. And he was just grinding it out, just insisting it was going to happen. He would. I recall, you asked about this UN Night Day and where I was with Harvard and everything. He had me running around on so many different things and just getting that antenna, the first antenna up there, and pasting that together down in Kitchewick. We did it at the D.S. Kennedy Company. 24 feet in diameter. No idea how we're going to move it. Bart said we don't have enough money to build a template. So, and we can't, therefore, bolt it together later. So how are we going to move it? That's your job. All right, Bart. So I went on a little trip off to Australia, and by the time I got back, Kennedy had 24-foot antenna ready to go. So I called and said, well, take it up on 28. The governor said, no way. We're not going to drive it up on 28. You know, impossible. Congestion, traffic. So we'll fly it. Helicopter. I made arrangements to fly it up with a chopper. And I recall the phone call very well. Probably on the phone to vice president of the Harvard Corporation. I want to talk to Doc Ewan. Speaking. He said, which one am I talking to? Is it the president of the UN Night Corporation? The president of the UN Day Corporation? The member of the Harvard faculty? Or the guy that's going to fly an antenna with a helicopter over the top of Cambridge? Which one of these guys are you? Are they all the same?
They're all the same.
He said, I was afraid of that.
Right.
He said, I go, this guy, and it's all the same guy. And he said, I just want to tell the fellows in charge of that helicopter operation that if you drop that antenna on anyone's head, you better have it insured for $2.5 million. And so that meant I just couldn't get it up there with a helicopter. But it was that some part said, okay, Doc, just figure out how you're going to do it. So I said, well, we got to get a Harvard governor in, and we'll have it made. And we got Herder in, went down, boom. We can run it up on 28 in the truck.
So just, which governor was it again?
Herder.
Herder?
Yeah, he let us take it by truck. We had to wait until the election went through.
we got off the subject of the style of doing radio astronomy, more or less. Do you think I'm being unfair in saying that some things were overinterpreted in the data that came out of it, Agassiz, both with the first dish and the second one? Of course, you weren't so involved in that side of things.
My feeling was, looking back, of course, this is the difficult part of it, is the question you're asking is an assessment after the fact, which
right.
is a way I had assessed it anyway. While it was going on, I was more preoccupied with Agassiz and its operation and that sort of thing. But I think a good deal of that could have been brought about by what might have been a natural anticipation concerning certain models. It's not common just to that era.
Oh, sure. And you mean wanting something to be
right
there?
Right, and that's not in large measure just the student. Though I know, even in my own case, as we discussed earlier, I was very convinced that it was there in 3 days, but Purcell was not.
Yeah.
Which is far more realistic. Now, the reverse, I'm sure, has happened historically.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I happen to be favored with a conservative line advisor.
Okay.
But so it would be, I think it would be not appropriate for me to comment on what the motivation was.
Yeah.
Only that I feel there it was probably. It was not so much of an instrument problem as a motivation.
So you might say there was some overenthusiasm about
right. you can
running with these results. Yeah.
Because we were certainly in a competitive race at that time. Once the Dutch goblet had been dropped.
Now, you mentioned that before the line was detected, that you went around to AAS and IRSI meetings and found them not of much use. But in the years with when you and Bach were running the show there, you went to many AAS meetings. It looks mm-hmm. like and. I mean, did you find that you were then becoming accepted?
Yes, right.
Is this because Bach, traditional astronomer, had bridged the gap?
He just kept pounding on that door and said, open the door. And of course, internationally in the IAU, Ort was a Bach.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
So the doors just were blown open by those two Dutchmen, Ort and Bach.
What about your relationship with the Dutch? Of course, I guess you were not so much in on the decisions about the science that was going to be done. Where should we look?
No, that was you
weren't really part of that.
Right.
Okay, but were you influenced at all about what was going on with the Dutch and the Australians, or for instance, I mean, maybe did you pick up any engineering things from Mueller and the Australians, or was it pretty much just you just operated yourself?
Right. There was. I did visit.
Twenge Lo.
And
Twenge Lo.
Right.
Yeah.
And there wasn't, and also in Australia, I didn't see anything in Holland or Australia that competitively would mm-hmm. Really make that much difference in what
yeah.
we were doing. There's so much that was going on here in electronics, and particularly in the Boston area,
yeah.
that it became more a question of the radio astronomy community being able to afford what
yeah.
was available. It's pretty much the same today. So I see fellows who are struggling to build a 95 gigahertz machine. You can buy it for 10,000.
They don't have the money. Yeah.
I just don't have the 10,000.
Yeah.
So they'll have some student over in the corner
yeah.
Discovering whether he can get his right chip working.
Well, this is
it's
right. It's the same story. I mean, this society will give it to the military, but not, mm-hmm. not to the scientists.
And I think from that standpoint, my familiarity with that side of it, which if I were completely in academia, if I weren't looking at the other side, or have access to that,
mm-hmm.
My whole life would have been a good deal different.
With yeah.
academia. So that occasionally, rather frequently, I do get calls from people in academia that want to know what really is going on.
Yeah.
At that time, for example, in 50, probably a fact not too well known historically, the first Maser was successfully demonstrated by Lincoln Lab. 90 days later, the second and the first in industry was demonstrated by Ewan Knight.
I noticed you had an article here on Masers.
Oh, well, that wasn't really on Masers, but it says Masers in the title.
Yeah.
But it's more on things, problems you have if you have amazing. And many people have commented, not so much on the title, but it was the first paper that really took a look at all of those. And that we were working on the details of how to measure the noise figure on Maser. And right, that was a gas discharge.
We're talking about a paper in Microwave Journal in 1959. So you and Knight had one going at a very early stage.
Right, we were second on the air, 90 days, and Bell followed us 4 months later. So now, the way that was done was, and then Harvard got on the air, I guess right about time Bell did. So here was Nico Bloomberg, couldn't get his Maser running, Lincoln got it running. But by sitting in the outer loop,
yeah,
it was very simple, and this was a typical example. That Ewan Knight was deeply involved in the Polaris program at that time, 55 to 60. We were doing something over $10 million worth of research in navigation, using radio stars for celestial navigation under foul weather conditions.
I see.
And we were that central part of getting the azimuth right. As Red Rayburn, or the Admiral, used to say in Polaris, "I know exactly where I am, but if I don't get my azimuth right, it could land on Washington." So, we were charged with responsibility to make sure that he fired in the correct direction and under all weather, and that brought on radio stars, and we were looking at radio stars at about the time NRL was publishing the Haddock with the 50-footer.
Right.
I'd seen a few radio stars. You see those, you could probably appreciate those in terms of X-band with a 28-footer.
Right.
That's centroid sensing and sequential lobing on Cass A and Taurus. And that's radiometric sextants at its best. That's about as good as we can.
This is beam switching, so you get, first you get a positive, then negative.
Mm-hmm.
But now,
it's just scanning across.
The submarine came to the surface in a dish?
No, this was brought up. Submarine stayed below, and this came up on a coast.
I see.
And a state 5C, and all that good news. And the transmission line was something like 75 feet long.
Hmm.
And that did not include all the bends and quick disconnects. You see, if we had to submerge immediately, we had to have a quick disconnect in the guide. This had to be a very low noise transmission line, so I had transitions from X-band into C-band in circular guide, and then gather it all back together into X-band, get it into the receiver, it was way down on the bottom deck. So while I was building these things for 10-15K, here I had, when the Maser was first announced by Bloomberg, Red Rayburn called and said, "Doc, need one of those. Low noise. There's one thing you told me about radiometry. Low noise." "Yes, sir." I said, "I also said bandwidth and time." And so I said, "Oh, come on. I gotta have one of these. It sounds terrific. Great gadget."
Right.
And I said, "Well, let's be second. Let's not be first." And because it's, up to this point, it's a theory. As soon as Lincoln Lab got on the air, he got on the phone. "Doc, they did it.
Right.
When do I get mine?" "This Admiral, it's expensive." "How much?" $1 million. "Come on down, I got $1 million. I'm down there," he said. "I want this guy to have a contract, 10 days, $1 million. And I want a Maser, quick. I want one right now." I said, "You know, a Maser is just gonna give you a low noise amplifier, it's way down the bottom of the ship, you got all of this transmission line. We need liquid helium. You don't have closed liquid helium systems. What are those?" "Oh, liquid helium, like all the time. You're out there in a submarine, can't say, 'Hey, bring me one of those Lindair products things.'"
"I didn't know there was liquid helium."
"Yeah," he said, "All right, let's build one." "Oh, well, let's get on that. Let's have a closed helium system." And I got that going. So I had guys under contract building closed liquid helium systems and get the Maser going. Call Lincoln Lab, said, "How did you ever get the Maser going? What did you use?" I said, "Chromium cobalt cyanide. Just a simple-minded crystal. You can build it in a home refrigerator." "Call Nico Bloombergen. Why aren't you using chromium cobalt cyanide?" "We don't know how to do it. There's a trick to it." Back to Lincoln. "What's the trick?" "A fellow by the name of Professor Wolf over at BU. He knows how to do it, and he's got the refrigerator." "Call Wolf." I said, "You just got hired. You and Knight Corporation. Bring your instant refrigerator. We're building chromium cobalt cyanide. We had crystals out because of over in Natick here." So I sent him to Harvard. And, you know, Follis, really. I'm a Harvard man. We can't say we really got it from Lincoln. I hired Wolf. So here you are. Get a Maser on here.
How many radio stars Now, which sources were being used by the Polaris submarines?
The Polaris originally was a ship-launched missile, and it was a Jupiter missile. The navigation system, therefore, was ship-borne, and it used a 28-foot antenna. And the model of that, or the prototype, was the one that we assembled and put into Needham. The radio stars available to that were Cass, Taurus, Virgo, just typical
the
ones.
The big half dozen.
Right, exactly. And adequately dispersed to be good navigational aids. The next step in Polaris, then, was to move it to the submarine. And there we didn't have the advantage of 28 feet of aperture. So we were moved to about a 1 meter aperture and settled on the sun and the moon, centroid of sun and moon, and as a result became very interested in the centroid of the sun and the centroid of the moon, and whether we were going to be seeing lunation shifts in the centroid.
Or if a flare went off on one side of the sun.
And where would you look for a very quiet band? And in those days, in the late 50s, the quietest band we were able to find, where we weren't going to be interfered with atmospherically, and where we could also get a very broad bandwidth through the virtue of low noise traveling wave tubes, was 7.5 to 8 gigahertz. So we blocked that out for the U.S. Navy, and immediately Lincoln Lab blocked that out for the deep space satellite communication system.
Oh, yes.
That was a very quiet place.
And in fact, you developed, along with Frank Drake was just telling me about this a few months ago, the traveling wave tube for 8 gigahertz
right.
for radio astronomy. This apparently was the same receiver,
basically. Same one was built for Polaris.
With a bandwidth of like 1 gigahertz or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. That's the one we used to get the rings of Saturn and get a comparison with the Jupiter intensity.
Okay. Now, can you just tell me a little bit about the actual receivers that you delivered over to Agassiz and what improvements that were made through those 5 years or so?
The approach taken on the receivers was primarily in packaging early on, and it continued. And that was to make it easy for the astronomer to understand what the radio or radiometer was all about. And one of the early novel approaches, which we continue throughout, was to engrave the block diagram on the front panel.
Which NREO still does.
Right, and put the knob in that part of the circuit. So it's very easy to explain to the new one coming online just exactly what's happening in there. Now, other than that, very little was done in the way of improving the noise figure. It remained the crystal mixer, the one in 21. Of course, it was done in coax rather than waveguide. And I would say improvements, possibly for those who understood how it operated, the gain modulator was an interesting advance. The number of people, particularly the astronomers, however, that did not understand some of the problems the gain modulator can carry you into, encouraged me. Within 5 years after that was developed, to drop it as a technique.
I see.
And perhaps urged most by the group in British Columbia that bought one, did not know what it was at all, and then started...
Penticton?
Penticton. And just tore the whole machine apart, trying to find out what that was all about, and so I never again. We didn't. It was written up by a group at NRAO, but we did nothing further with it. So until the Parent came along, some years later, and well after we were out of the business providing radio telescopes, we did provide some radio telescopes with masers to the military, but not to academia.
Right. Just too expensive.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And so we, I would say our contribution in that field ended with one attempt, knowing that we could improve on noise figure. Nor could we slow the Earth down, rotating, so time was pretty well set for us. We said, well, we'll go to multi-channel. And I think we were probably the first to attempt that, and followed shortly thereafter by the group at Carnegie and then...
The Australians also were putting together a multi-channel thing.
Right. So we tried 100 channels. Flat little bandwidths from 1 to 10 kilohertz. And digital outputs with a driver to a typewriter. And that was an effort we launched in 54. And it nearly launched us. as I recall, NSF grant was for something like $40,000 to try to build that. And we spent an awful lot of time on it. We learned a lot. The education was, should have probably been documented. And that's something I think would have, all of radio astronomy would have benefited from, and probably still would, is if we could teach the engineers that are coming along and that are doing the building to document mistakes.
Sure.
That would be so helpful.
That's true. All of life, about, actually.
Right. If we could only have a publication for mistakes only with the guts to do it. So that was our big mistake.
What were the problems with it?
Oh, it's just a matter of inadequate funds to do a prototype study in adequate detail to determine whether there would be any problems. There was the need to go onto a schedule where you commit to a design, and if you made a mistake on paper, it's too late. You don't have the money to buy the paper. So just a horrendous clue.
Well, from a management point of view.
Now, from the technical standpoint, the problem was primarily the determination of zeros baseline between various channels. And that was because we did not have contiguous filtering as a consequence of the selection of very narrow bandwidths.
The centers were 5 kilohertz apart.
There were possibly more, as I think... they might have been as much as 20 or 30 kilohertz. Even the 10 had to be scanned.
Because you wanted to cover the entire galactic line in one shot.
So what we're trying to do is, we're trying to get as much bandwidth as possible with a small amount of tuning to fill in the gaps and hopefully to operate on a broad resonant characteristic of the front end so that the baseline would not be distorted. Not so. We struggled with it, let me say. So it was to the point that with a lot of care and tweaking and picking the correct frequencies for the various hadronic circuits, we were able to type up a line that was realistic, correct.
At one time you did
it. We did that by everyone inhaling and exhaling at the same time.
And your hat and your shirt put on.
Or a tie up on that rod. We took it all down and said, put it back on the strip chart. So we, other than that attempt, I would say things like low noise amplifiers and computer processing, getting rid of tail ends and doing the job right. I think we're getting now very close to the point. As the speed of computers builds up and as hopefully the Josephson effect can be used by IBM effect, then we can tie a computer to the tail end of an antenna. We've got something.
So, what actually was the noise figure of your initial 21 centimeter radiometer?
I would say it was probably around 10 dB, about a 3,000 degree noise temperature, and we probably never did see better than 2,000.
By the late 50s.
Right. Yeah. While in the lab, in the very same lab we were playing with masers, it could not be afforded by academia.
Something that just occurred to me was that there's this famous picture of you and other 21 centimeter people at the university meeting in Sydney in 1952. You remember going down for that? Can you just tell me what your impressions were of the Australian group at that time? You probably toured around all the sites.
Other than my first impression of a very gung-ho group, just a wonderful group of people, particularly Wild and Paul Wilder. Interested in so many things. And of course, Pawsey was there, and I think
Bolton.
Right, Bolton, and that was before Bolton came here.
Mills.
It was just it was a meeting with eager minds, just delighted to be afforded the opportunity to get together and chat about what we're really doing in this field. A meeting that was not typical of what you find here in the U.S. in the field even at that time. A year later, or even 5 years later. It was just an excitement. It was a camaraderie.
What about the equipment that you saw around there? Was that sort of shoestring stuff?
It was shoestring stuff, but it was cute. A lot of cute tricks. They had thought it through. They wouldn't waste much time in the hardware areas
where it wasn't all that important to make it look pretty or whatever. But wherever a part was critical to the operation of the device, they spent a lot of time thinking about it, and they had a lot of innovative techniques that they'd used, just a feeling of someone that wants to do a good job, knows where you have to exert the effort, and is very familiar with what counts and what doesn't. Just a very, very pleasant surprise. I think they're good. Number one.
Okay, well, I think that pretty well covers my thing up to 1960. Thank you.
Good.
That is the interview with Harold Doc Ewan at his home in Weston, Mass. On 12 August 1979.